Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. And when we think of the great teams in history, the Bogies and the Bacalls, the Samsons and the Delilahs, we have to, I guess, include in that list the Efrons and the Olsons, in a manner of speaking. Marshall Efron and Alpha Betty Olson have been a team involved in writing and humor and also television for, I guess, I don't want to overstate their ages, but it's got to be about 40 or 50 years now. Yes, Alpha?
No, since the Great American Dream Machine in 1972, I believe.
80, 90, oh, so it's only about 30, 40 years. See, I'm sorry I aged you prematurely already.
Yes.
If people remember from public television the Great American Dream Machine, which came out only a couple of years after public TV was invented. It was, how do you even describe it, like CBS's Sunday Morning meets Bill Maher meets Saturday Night Live. I can't even really think of the best way to think about it. It was all these little bits and pieces and segments, some satirical, some not. Marshall became sort of the face of it, one of the faces on the show.
I was the icon.
That's right.
I was the icon on that, but thank God they weren't paying me that kind of money that I deserved.
That you roundly deserve, but also you and Alpha Betty. See, she was the writer on a lot of these pieces, or you co-wrote some of them. You were the front face of it, and I guess that also led to what I knew you best for, and I'll bet you a bunch of the listeners to this program did, if they watched television on Sunday mornings, and after all these religious programming in Fulton Sheen and Sunrise Semester and what have you, suddenly there was this one man doing these Bible stories, both from the Old Testament and the New, in a comical, bizarre sort of fashion, called Marshall Efron's Simplified...
Illustrated, Simplified, and Painless Sunday School.
Painless Sunday School.
We did 48 shows altogether, and then they repeated them from 1973 to 87.
Oh, it was all the way out through 87. I'm so glad that, like, two generations got a chance to enjoy that show.
Also, because of the show, we did a book for E.P. Dutton called A Bible Stories You Can't Forget No Matter How Hard You Try.
And that's available on ABE, if anyone has a computer out there.
You mean A Books, or AB is something else?
It stands for Advanced Book Exchange.
Oh, cool.
You Google it, ABE.
It's ABE.com, and you can buy any book you ever dreamed of through that website.
How did you guys meet?
Well,
I hired her.
Yes.
Was it really true? You needed a writer, or?
Marshall had, I had worked with Mel Brooks. I worked with Mel Brooks on the movie The Producers, the first movie, The Producers.
I've heard of it.
And I also cast it.
Oh my God, you know what? I'm not going to stop the tape, but we have to stop right there, Alpha Betty,
sure.
Because just mentioning that, I need to sidetrack down that alley. I didn't remember that or realize that, so I've got to ask like two or three questions just about working on...
What about me? Am I being abandoned?
Momentarily, yeah. This was supposed
to... Pride is on the line.
Well, when we get to the Sunday school thing, I'll get to you, Marshall. Sir Marshall. You want to be called Sir Marshall, is that
but
true?
But little is left of that ash that you... Me.
I doubt that highly. But Alpha Betty, how did you hook up, first of all, with Mel Brooks in a professional manner of speaking?
Well, I knew him, and one day he said, "You can type and I can't."
Okay, that's good. Right.
And I have to turn this in on Monday. And so we used the weekend and I typed.
Was it?
And
yeah.
Did
he recite everything to you and you just took it down, or did he have a
notes? Alpha Betty doesn't take recitation.
Oh.
That's what she goes along.
No, it's more like, you know, when they were doing the show of shows, the Sid Caesar
sure.
show of shows?
Of course.
They had all those writers in one room, Neil Simon and Mel Tolkien and Mel and Carl Reiner. And in the corner, in the latter days...
Woody Allen, right?
Woody Allen.
Uh-huh.
And he was the guy on the typewriter. So whoever runs the typewriter has a lot of power, if you know what I mean.
Because you can accidentally miss forget to type the joke you don't like and edit as you please. Were you able to do so?
The typewriter is a weapon. But anyway, and it's a lot of, and it was a lot of fun. It really was a lot of fun.
I'll bet.
And the movie was made in New York on a very low budget, and it was really almost a home movie.
Well, he got Joseph E. Levine to produce it, so he got somebody.
Yeah, it was also at the same time as The Graduate.
Right.
And which was ironic, because Anne Bancroft, Mel's wife, was in The Graduate. Which, was their important movie.
Abco Embassy.
Yeah, Embassy. So, anyway, there are so many stories surrounding that entire episode.
Oh, I'll just bow out.
No. Don't go away, fine, Marshall. Don't go away. I mean, I know you've probably heard these stories a million times because, you're married to her, but I haven't heard them yet. You're not married.
No.
Are you a couple or are you just professional partners?
We're just professional writers.
Oh, my
Marshall,
goodness.
Yes. And Marshall, of course, is a performer.
I'm a performer.
Well, yes, I realize that. I always assumed you were a couple as well as a...
Bad assumption.
Right, a lot of people do that.
Right.
Yes.
And for a long time we used to use the word partner, but now the word partner...
Right. You figure...
Has bad connotations. So there's nothing left.
Are either of you married?
No.
Oh, gosh.
Definitely so.
Okay. Do you think one of the reasons that you haven't gone on to marry other people is because, as a partnership, that fulfills everything you need from another person in your life?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why. Do you know why, Albany?
No, well, I was married.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
When we first started working together.
She's married.
Actually.
Huh. Okay. Forgive me, I didn't want it to veer off into another...
I'm not forgiven.
Actually, there are other collaborations like Comden and Green.
They were
married to other people.
So do you do the thing like you meet 4 or 5 days a week from 9 to 4 and you work...
We live in the same building.
Yeah.
I'm on the 9th floor.
Uh-huh.
The 3rd.
Okay.
And we bless the 6 floors that separate us.
So, but is it true that you force yourselves to... I mean, it's a job. You go to work.
No, I wish we did. I wish there was a job where someone was paying us.
Oh, well, right. But how many hours a week do you put together, and how much do you work apart?
We work a lot of together.
Well, cool.
Don't we help any?
Yes.
Okay.
And waste a lot of time.
Well, that was always par for the course. I mean, you get a writer's in a room, the first hour is spitballing, the second hour is napping, the third hour is food. And then by about 4:15, it's like, hey, we have to put something on paper. And
like napping.
Napping's good. Napping's nice. Actually, one bit I remember vaguely, wasn't even much of a bit, but I'll never forget it, on American Dream Machine, you once went to a podium to answer the all-important question, is there sex after death?
And I answered it negatively.
Yeah, you just said no. You closed the book and you walked off. It was very disturbing in an interesting way. I wonder if there's sex before death, because I'm married.
With some people, it's dubious.
So how did you get the Dream Machine gig?
I came back from Spain, where I was doing spaghetti westerns.
Wow.
And I called up a friend of mine. I was very, I was heated. I was not hot, but heated. I was ambitious and I wanted jobs right away. I went to Spain to do the movie Doc. Frank Perry's picture was Stacy Keach and Faye Dunaway.
Okay.
And behind me on the seat, in the airplane, in the Sabina airplane, was Dan Greenberg and his wife, Nora Ephron.
Oh, my gosh.
And I knew Nora from high school.
And you're not related, by the way, even though you have the...
No way.
I know, different...
I'll tell you.
Uh-oh.
Can I tell him, Alfetti?
I don't know what you're going to tell
him. And you're not related to Zac Efron either.
His name is Efron.
Ah, okay.
Here's what Efron... Efron is not a name that goes from Genesis 18:23 down through the ages to become... the, you know, ultimate environmental, ecological, whatever, derivative. It's not that at all. Efron is the name that is given as a title to any middle-class Jew who endows a cemetery in Poland or Russia.
So, in other words, your ancestral name would have been very different from Efron, but you don't know what he is.
Schneiber, Schneigelager, von Sonsurschnisch,
So Efron goes back to Ellis Island, or just previous? Is that the deal, or...?
Russia. It goes back to Russia and Poland. Ukraine. It has to do with somebody in my background, some ancestor of mine, endowed a Jewish cemetery.
Now, would that have been the same for Nora Ephron's family, too? Even
yes.
Though, okay.
It all comes out of the Cyrillic, so an EPH, an EFF, an HEFF, EF, it's all the same. I'm not related to Zac Efron.
Right, okay. And nor I've forgotten about her, whom you were sitting in front of.
Zac Efron either, unless she wants to be.
Right. No, God, I'm trying to do a straight line in this conversation, and it's
just,
there's
try.
No way. Dan Greenberg, he wrote How to Be a Jewish Mother, was singing next
exactly.
to Nora Ephron. Are they related? Or they're just Jewish?
They're married. They're married to each other.
Okay, wow. I found somebody who is married.
Each other carnally, yes.
Okay. Now, you talked to them on the airplane. They were involved in Dream Machine. Was that the
deal? I knew her from before. No, they had nothing to do with it. Dream Machine was a figment at the time. Dream Machine was not anybody's possibility at that moment when we flew out in August of 1970.
Uh-huh.
To Almeria.
Okay. And so?
I was a contract player in the movie.
Right, in the Duck movie. Doc movie, yeah.
Duck.
Sorry, that one I don't remember, unfortunately.
What did you? What, were you one of the, you were not one of the seven who saw it?
I'm 45 years old, so there's certain things that were a little before my time and certain things that, you know, I kind of caught up with. But how did you guys get involved in Great American Dream Machine?
Well, I hired Alphabetti. My producer, co-writer, Betty, quit me. She quit me. She said, "Go to bed. I have been awarded a new show. I won't be working with you."
Oh.
Man.
Okay.
So she's coming, little man.
Really?
So that was on a Friday. And Marshall and I had a mutual friend, Bridget Potter. And Bridget told Marshall to call me. So Marshall called me, and I perceived him as the star of the show.
Anyone else would have.
And by show business rules, I assumed he had the right to hire me. So he promised me that we would put internal rhyme into everything we wrote.
Yes.
And gave me the address. And I showed up.
You see, she just did it. She said, I said yes, she said address.
Very good.
And so I showed up for work on Monday morning, and it took 6 weeks to straighten the whole thing out, and I finally got a contract and got paid.
I'm wondering, did it ever bother you, Alphabetti, that Marshall was always the front face? Were you always comfortable just being the behind the scenes, whereas obviously the person who gets his face on camera becomes the more famous one and is credited for all the comedy and all the et cetera. Well, you were the co-writer.
Well, yeah. Well, that's what the job was.
Hmm.
You know,
okay.
Neither Marshall nor I have the ability to affect that. You know, it's the people who sign the checks who make those decisions anyway.
Right, but maybe there was, let's say, when the decision was made to do the simplified, illustrated, and painless Sunday school show. Whose idea was it to have a one-person show?
You had no budget.
No. Remember, that was Marshall's idea. The concept was there was a Japanese performer.
Chinese.
Who, Chinese? Yes. He was Japanese.
No, he was Chinese.
Right.
He was fabulous.
Right. And he used to do a one-man Hamlet. He did a Hamlet.
Uh-huh.
All the parts. Himself.
Okay, the death scenes must have been interesting. Okay.
It was fabulous. He used Laertes was a blow-up dummy. With one of those things you kick at the beach, you know, it has a...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he had a bottle of ketchup. So he would fight Laertes and then squirt ketchup on him.
That sounds wonderful, actually.
On the floor.
Yeah.
And he was great. I mean, it was like one of the great shows of all time. He had studied both with Stanislavski and with the Chinese Art Theater. He was a great, great actor, and he was in 20th Century Fox movies.
What was his name?
I forgot his name, but he was in the movie The Purple Heart by Lewis Milestone.
Okay.
He played the bad Chinese guy whose son stabs him in the back.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I guess we can Google that or IMDb it. So you had this idea then, why not do, and did you approach CBS and say, we want to do Bible stories? I mean, where did that idea come from?
We had a wonderful agent at that time, Marion Searchinger. She's not with us any longer, but Marion was terrific. And she actually dreamed it up and talked the woman who ran that division, that part of CBS.
CBS News Religion.
Which happened on Sunday mornings.
Pamela Hyland.
Into doing this. And in those days, television was much more relaxed and much easier and much more willing to take chances. And in the religious department, no one cared what they did.
At all. And also, Pamela had autonomy for that reason. In the two and a half hours that she had, look up and lay the lamp unto my feet.
Right.
So it was a much more experimental world. You know, the Dream Machine was very experimental.
But that was PBS.
That was PBS. But I mean, television was much easier then. Of course, it was corporations, but it was just more relaxed.
I don't recall. Did you have commercials on your show? I think it was straight through. Even.
Oh, we had a full 29-minute show.
Yeah,
what it was it fulfilled CBS's obligation to do public service. I think that obligation has disappeared now. They don't have
to devote any
time to anything called public. You know, that would be construed as public service. But then you could. So a lot of people, a lot of actors. Made their first television appearances in this television time slot,
including James Dean.
James Dean?
And
he did the illustrating and painful Sunday School.
This was the
10 to 11 time slot on Sunday morning.
Or 10:30 to 11.
And they would do short plays. They would do all kinds of things.
Experimental stuff. They did a lot of good stuff.
I remember that. There were homilies, or there were fables that had kind of a meaning to them.
Or people in costumes. Or modern day paradigms.
Do you guys have a favorite sketch or bit that you did?
What they wouldn't let us do.
Oh, right. They wouldn't let us do this because they thought it would upset children.
I wanted to do what where Jesus comes and resurrects Lazarus.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The sisters praise Jesus. Oh, Jesus, you brought our brother back.
Well, we were trying to put green makeup on, have him rise up out of a coffin. They wouldn't let us do that because they said it would upset children. They may have been right.
But it was such a loss.
Was that the only censorship you encountered on that show?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I'm so sorry. You never taped it. They never even let you get it to. And not only didn't it run, you didn't even do the sketch, right? Or is it somewhere in a vault?
Oh, he said no.
Oh, they just said no.
We never done. Pamela said no.
Are those shows?
But our obligation. We knew our obligation very well, so we weren't going to scuttle it by becoming nasty or dirty or weird or anything like that, because the object was to do the show right.
Yeah, no, it was absolutely clean. I want to make that clear. Is it available anywhere?
We've dreamed that they might someday release them on DVD, and we do hear from people who ask, is it available anywhere on DVD? But so far, it's not.
Do you have any of your listeners with any power whatsoever? any of your audio listeners, the people with big ears?
If they ever break out of prison, I'll definitely let them know.
Well, ask them in their prison cells to please write letters to CBS and say, release it.
So CBS still holds the rights.
Good time, well served. Let Marshall Efron rise again from the dead.
Now, speaking of that, you did, as you said, the show for four or five seasons. And then, what? I mean, there you are. You're present every week on television.
Did you ever hear of a movie called Ice Age 2?
Oh, I know you did a lot of cartoon voices.
Years of Who.
Right, yeah.
I also did a lot of voiceovers in the golden years of what's it called, half-hour television. On Saturday morning kitty fair.
Oh, yeah.
Did a ton of that stuff.
And it's fun to bring this up because we just lost Arnold Stang, who was the voice of
Tonto. I worked a lot with Arnold. I loved him. He's a great man. He's a really sweet person.
Oh, man. Yeah. Unfortunately, I never got to interview him or meet him, but there was just obviously something special.
Oh, you left New York. You left New York. It was your choice.
I only left New York 4 months ago. I could have done it before then.
Well, you should have.
You're right, but what were some of the characters?
He's always available. He's a gentle, real nice person.
Yeah, I just don't know how. I mean, he was really out of the limelight for the past 10 years, so I assumed he was rather aged and perhaps unwell. I didn't even know how to contact him.
No, we did a Honey Nut commercial. He was the voice of the Honey Nut Bee.
Yes, I remember that. And you were
Estelle Harris.
Yeah,
I did a couple spots with them. I forgot what character I was. The honey
now, Estelle Harris, she was George Costanza's mother?
Yes, in Seinfeld.
Okay. And Marshall, what were some of the other cartoon folks that you did on Saturday mornings?
Oh, the Transformer. I've got hungry.
Oh, but also you were a Smurf.
I was a Smurf, yes. I was Sloppy Smurf.
You were not even
guys. I did a lot of shows, Kid Videos, Scooby-Doo. I mean, I appeared on a lot of shows as a guest. And I was regular on a lot of shows.
And Alpha, while Marshall was doing this, since you were the writer portion, were you writing books? Were you writing?
We did some books. Also, we wrote a movie for Disney, for Disney Television.
Uh-huh.
And we wrote some pilots that didn't lead to anything. And we wrote a few movies. It didn't get made.
Is that heartbreaking, or do you at least get some sort of fee, you know, on spec and...
You really do get paid for it, and it's to be biblical about it.
Well...
Many are called, but few are chosen.
Aye.
Well, when you go through, even if you're getting paid, isn't it, you write the script, especially for a movie, and it sits there and you send it around... And that moment that it comes back and you realize nothing.
It's not a moment. They dangle you. Green light, red light, red light, green light, red light, green light.
Can you share like one or two plots of the scripts that you...
Cult Wars?
We did Cult Wars. You know, do you remember back with the Hare Krishnas and the Moonies and...
Oh, sure, yeah.
All of that. Well, we wrote a movie called Cult Wars because we knew... that the cults hated each other and were vying for devotees.
Uh-huh.
Devotees. They called themselves devotees, but they were
right.
Devotees.
So this was kind of based on... the structure was that of kind of a gang war movie.
Like Warriors.
No, actually it sounds more like Spike Lee's School Days in a manner of speaking.
Spike Lee wasn't anywhere in those days.
That about that.
Spike Lee didn't exist.
It was an embryo, yeah.
So that got very close to being made.
It was green lighted.
And Michael Cimino's movie...
Heaven's Gate.
Heaven's Gate.
Killed us.
Bankrupted the studio.
He was getting outside the studio at the front stairs. And just then this guy came by with a dolly, and the dolly was filled with cans of film. And we said, oh, what's that? And he said, oh... Michael Cimino's going to give it another thing at home. He's going to give another pass at it to put it together. Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, man.
So the cloud, that little cloud that appeared on the horizon became a really twister in no time.
Oh, my gosh. That's a...
Stood us up.
Like in the past decade, have you even been part of that merry-go-round, or did you kind of climb off and do other things with just voices and children's books?
The last movie we wrote, which has not been made.
Which is sold.
Which is The Vikings.
You've heard of The Vikings?
The Vikings. Okay, yeah.
Yes. And that was two tween Viking girls who want to be heroes. Borghild and Hedvig.
And the guy who bought that, the family who bought that, the two husband and wife. He's currently directing the Kung Fu Kid in China.
Oh, okay. But that is not going to get made either, or is that just on the back burner?
I think it's on the back burner now.
Oh, okay.
And the Vi Queen is out.
The Vi Queens. Interesting.
The Queens.
Were you on Food Network or something like that?
Don't I wish.
Oh, you saw the sardine rare bit on YouTube?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, and that was what?
I paid for 20 cents.
Okay.
And I paid it.
Hi, this is Alpha Betty Olson.
And I used to be Marshall Evra.
And you're now listening to...
Days Gone By.
I want to talk to Marshall about some radio stuff, and I also want to talk to Alpha Betty more about the producers, because we never really did...
Very big news about her and the producers. You know, she basically co-wrote the movie. Still did the typewriter.
This is serious now. I mean, it's one thing to be there at the typewriter and do a little editing, but are there any jokes that you personally can take credit for?
Go ahead, Alpha Betty, tell it.
Well, I think I'd just rather not go there at this time.
Okay, don't go there.
I will tell you one story, though, from the producers.
Okay.
And that's, you know what, the big scene at the end with a fountain that comes up?
I love that, yes.
Well, the producers were shot on a very low budget, and it was, you know, kind of, and it was in New York City, and we were shooting in a studio on 26th Street, on West 26th Street, and at that time, we did not have any location for that scene. It was supposed to be the parachute jump at Coney Island, but the parachute jump had not been functioning for a couple of years, and when they tried to rent it, it turned out it was going to cost a ton of money to get it working again. And what was supposed to happen, this was my idea, what was supposed to happen, if you remember the old parachute jump, when you hit the top, there would be this jerk, and then there would be this very fast downward until the parachute opened.
Hmm.
And then you were left kind of hanging under the open parachute. So he was going to say, at the top of the world, Ma, which was an homage to Jimmy Cassidy,
right,
in
uh-huh.
White Heat. And then suddenly they were going to drop through the frame really fast. And anyway, so there was no place for this scene to happen. And also there was another thing that was lacking, which was a song for the audition sequence, because which was supposed to originally have been, everybody was going to sing a portion of I Could Have Danced All Night.
As
they wanted too much money for the rights to that song. So I went up to Lincoln Center, to the library up there, the theater library, to try and find something in public domain that could be used for the audition sequence. And I walked past the fountain, and I said, oh, maybe that'll work. I came back downtown, and I told Mel about it. So when the shooting for that day was over, we got in a cab, and we drove up to Lincoln Center, and Mel looked at the fountain. He said, okay, we'll use that.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful scenes in the film.
That turned out to be a great scene in the film.
And a signature moment.
Yeah. I mean, they repeat it. We mentioned that it's at the end on the credits, but it's also right smack in the middle of the film when Leo says, I'll do it. And the,
right.
You know, I mean, it's beautiful. It's moving, actually. And funny.
And then he runs around, and that was really slippery. he runs around the edge of the fountain, and that was a wonderful shoot, too.
And you were there for the shooting of the... You weren't just there for the writing, but you were there for the shooting as well.
Yes, and the editing.
Oh, so you were really a collaborator on this whole thing. Because I remember reading, because everybody on some level also wants to take credit for a masterpiece, so I remember reading Ralph Rosenblum's book. He was the editor, I believe, on the film.
Yeah.
And he wrote a biography of him, an autobiography. And according to him, if it weren't for him, the producers would never have left the editing table, and Annie Hall would never have left the editing table, and he sort of saved all these movies, which I guess there's some truth in that. But, you know, you also got to be like, okay, Ralph, you know, you're great, but you didn't
well,
write the thing, you know.
He and Mel did not get along, and it was difficult for them, for both of them.
Hmm.
You know, and And Ralph was very involved. And at that time, movies were supposed to be very kind of visual. You know, it was people running through the fields with the daisies waving. And there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. And Mel is really interested in getting the punchline, you know, to be where it has to be and to get the hard laugh. So they were, you know, at odds. They had different goals.
And also the first half hour of the film is office bound. It could be the first act of a play. It's, there's no room to go. It's two people in a room. And it's wonderful, but I can see a visual-oriented editor going berserk at that time of and saying,
right.
You've got to cut this. Or,
and Mel only wants, you know, the hard jokes.
Any other I'm sorry to leave you sort of out of the conversation, Marshall, but the producers is the producers.
I'm opening a vein right now.
Any other memories or thoughts of being there throughout the whole making of really the greatest comedy of all time?
Well, you know, it was, I said this before, it was like a home movie. Nobody was paying any attention to us. Oh, and you know what else we did? Every night we went to Max's Kansas City for dinner.
Max's Kansas City? Wouldn't that have been rock and roll and the Velvet Underground playing there? And
Well, Max's Kansas City really started as a place for artists. The rock and roll came in its latter days, very much latter days.
Okay, because producers were 69, 70.
Amazing place ever.
Yeah.
And I was there, only Al, Billy, and I didn't know each other. And I'd be in the back room, and I don't know where she was.
Oh, what was? She was up there with Mel Brooks and Zero Mostel.
I wouldn't have known Mel Brooks, who the hell he was.
Well, you would have known. Was Zero difficult?
Mickey didn't. Mickey Ruskin, who owned Max's, didn't. He told me later, he said, you know, I just thought he was a funny guy.
Hmm. Was Zero Mostel difficult on the shoot, or was he a pro?
He was medium difficult. He had been in an accident, I think the year before, and his leg had been crushed.
Oh.
And then kind of put back together. So there were moments when that was it. You know, he couldn't go any further. Do you know?
Right.
The premiere of The Producers was at a suburban theater in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And with no advance publicity or advertising to speak of. And so we went down early in the morning on the train to Philadelphia, and Mel did a radio show and a television show to try and publicize it.
Uh-huh.
And the host of the television show, and Mel was terrific. I mean, he did imitations and all kinds of things. And the guy got very excited, the host of the show, and he said he was going to come to see it. And so we went to the theater. There was hardly anyone in the theater, and it was very cold.
Oh.
And Joe Levine and a couple of the guys from his office came down in a limo. And we sat in the theater. And
the movie played.
You know, it was just great to see it on a big screen. And suddenly Mel said, nobody's laughing.
Well, it's tough.
Looked around and, no, nobody was laughing.
All eight people in the audience.
Right, yeah.
Right. Anyway.
Tell what the movie was that was playing with it.
Oh, no, it followed a movie called Helga, a film of childbirth. I'm not making it. That was the movie that preceded it.
That was the second biggest comedy ever made.
Anyway, then when we went to leave the movie theater, the host of that television show cut us dead. He walked past us.
Oh.
We were the biggest losers he'd ever come across. I don't know.
Oh, man. Well, at least he showed up, but I guess he was.
And the people from Joe Levine's office got in the limo and drove away, and then we had to figure out how to get back to New York.
Oh, that's sweet. That's nice.
So what you did? What was the trick?
Oh, and so then we found a drugstore. We called a cab. We got to a late train, and the car that we were in was filled with these guys who'd gone to Philadelphia to see a wrestling match.
Oh, no.
And they were big fans of Gorilla Monsoon. And Gorilla Monsoon's big number as a wrestler was the airplane spin. He would pick somebody up, and then he would go in a circle really fast.
Yeah.
Going over his head. And one of the guys, in the train was trying to do that.
Oh,
for reenacting the fight, because they loved it so much.
And we just sat there and stared out the window.
Oh, what a...
On the
premiere, well, one premiere of the... That's, oh my gosh. But at what point did you... I know you don't want to say bad things, but why did you have a fight with Mel Brooks? Didn't you suddenly feel it wasn't funny?
Oh, there were a lot of things. There were disagreements.
Oh, okay.
Stuff.
When you saw the film, even though people weren't laughing, did that change your notion of the movie? It's like when Groucho Marx never liked Duck Soup because it was a flop, because America wasn't ready for an anti-war satire, just as they were ramping up for World War II. Was watching the movie in those early stages, did that suddenly throw a panic of doubt of saying, well, we thought this was funny, but guess it's not?
No, I just loved every minute.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
But Mel recently, we talked about this fairly recently, and Mel said when he got home from the train from Philadelphia, he didn't sleep. And he and Ann just sat up, and she tried to make him, you know, pep him up and feel better, but he was really, really depressed.
And was it when it finally opened broader, or did it take the Academy Award to change things around? I mean,
yeah, yes, but I don't think it ever cumulatively ever really made that much money.
Well, not just about the money, but the realization that at the very least for a cult audience, from start to finish, it's the funniest movie ever made.
Nobody looks for a cult audience. I'd say, oh boy, well this is going to be for the cult.
If it weren't for cult audiences, I wouldn't be here.
Except, wait a minute, except for our old friend, Paul Bartel.
Oh, Paul Bartel!
Always aimed at the cults. I'm going to make another cult movie. Oh, right, after Lust in the Dust. Didn't you do it?
We lost him a few years ago, but Mary Warrenov is alive, or are they both gone?
Mary's gone. Mary's still here.
Mary's still here. Better get that one straight. So, Marshall, I'm sorry to keep you silent for so long, but now it's your turn. Now I want to hear about your years in...
I have nothing to compare.
Well...
No, I've opened a vein, and I'm enjoying it.
Oh, is it messy? You were the sloppy Smurf. So I guess that makes sense.
I'm a sloppy Smurf. I enjoyed that. And the Transformer and Scooby-Doo. And I just did a lot of kid video. I did a lot of TV.
But you were doing freeform FM radio in...
Yes, sir.
Back in the late 60s, the early 70s? When?
Starting in the late 60s when I moved to New York from Pittsburgh, PA.
And, I mean, do you have any specific amazing memories? Because radio is very close.
None whatsoever. I don't remember anything.
All right, well, and
I'll tell you one thing. Paul Krasner and I did this with Bridget Potter. This is 1968, and at the time, there were big sit-ins at Columbia University, so we pretended...
This is anti-Vietnam War.
Yeah, we pretended to be Columbia students and had taken over the radio station BAI.
Right, that's on your Wikipedia bio.
Judy Collins Records. And the cops kept coming. It's just a gag. It's a gag. Don't you get it? It's a gag. Hoax. Damn you.
Did you get into trouble for it, or was it just...
They kept coming. The cops kept coming. We said, it's a gag.
And there were people listening in who really thought it was real.
Yeah.
And who alerted the police.
Yeah. It was great.
It's war of the college world,
and
I
NBC called it the first-rate hoax. We loved that.
Well, were you hippies-ish, or were you just trying to get by as artists, or...
What do you mean?
Politically, like in that time, it was a very...
I'm political. I'm a lefty.
Okay.
Well, Marsha, you were a founding yippie.
I'm a founding yippie.
Seriously?
A party, yeah. I worked at City Lights Bookstore early on in my youth.
In San Francisco?
Yeah, San Francisco. I was rescued by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I have a lot of history. I'm the legendary one. I'm a legend, I tell you. A legend.
But wait a minute. You weren't in the Chicago 7.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't even in Chicago. I was on Broadway at the time. I wasn't going to leave my Broadway job on Broadway as an actor.
Wait, what?
And mess around in Chicago with a bunch of losers.
That's very right-wing sound.
It was a hit show. I was in a hit show.
What show?
Saturday, I was shaving, and I heard that we'd won the Pulitzer Prize. That's what I like.
Wait a minute. Wait, what Broadway show were you in?
Great White Hope.
Really? That was the one with James Earl Jones and...
I would like to think so. I'd like to think so, yes.
What did you play?
I was Ragashi, the Hungarian impresario.
Oh, my gosh. I did
so
that.
I had a good time on that, and I was over on the radio, and I'd leave the theater, put on my boots, and I'd go over to the radio station and be on the radio for a long time at night with Bob Sasser, Steve Post. And then I'd go home and sleep and then get up and then do the matinee if it was a matinee day or there. I got the attendance award.
No, that's a very exciting time. That must have been, I'll bet that's one of the highlights of being able to be on Broadway, then go do some radio and live that New York life. I'll bet that was one of the best times of your life.
A couple of times. I was also in the hit on Broadway later on when we did Much Ado About Nothing, the Shakespeare production.
Who was the director?
I was in the park first, in Central Park, and then with Sam Waterston and Kathy Widows. And I've been in some classic movies. I did THX 1138 with George Lucas directing, and Bobby DeVale is the star. And I did Much Ado, Bang the Drum Slowly.
Do you prefer TV or movies?
I prefer a job.
Okay.
Listen, if anybody listening wants to send me some money, I'd prefer that. Love that. Any of your listeners, all four of them, if they want to send me $20, I'd accept it. They send it to care of you, and then you can forward it to me.
Well, I take 15% because, you know, I...
I'll take any percentage you want. Take 80%. I don't care.
Well, let me ask you. It's a fair question. You guys have been, as we said, about at this job for 30 years. You've done TV, you've done movies. You should be getting... Are you able to live comfortably if you never work again?
Yes.
Just from residuals?
No, we live very happily.
Great.
Well, we just did... had a reading of a musical that we've been working on for a while.
Yes, at the York Theater. That's what made me think to call you in the first place. And thank
okay.
you to...
All right.
Yes.
What about this? And you let us go this far without mentioning it?
Sorry.
Oh, the scandal.
No, because I've always thought about injury, and then I get on to other things, and then I saw suddenly from... It was the York Theater, right? And I saw, oh my God, a Marshall Efron and Alpha Bank, the Olsen musical? I gotta get in touch with them. And it was through the York Theater.
Why didn't you?
I did. I am now.
That was an absolutely thrilling experience.
The show turned out great. Really great. I mean, surprised me, delighted me. I'm enthusiastic.
Well, what is it? What is it called? And what's it about?
It was called Sin City Fables. And it was originally, it started because we wrote a book of fables called Sin City Fables.
May I just interrupt for one second?
Yeah,
sure.
If your audience, both of them,
yes,
could go to ABE, that is on Google, go to Google and then do ABE, that's Advanced Book Exchange, and then go Olsen Efron, OLSEN/Efron, EFRON, and then they can see all the books that we wrote, and they can purchase Sin City Fables from one of the bookstores.
Do you have a stock in that company or something?
but this is the
story. No, we have nothing to do with them. I like them.
Oh, okay. No, it's cool. Because everybody else has
story
Amazon. And so, yeah, okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I went over to the Bottom Line. This is a while ago. I went over to the Bottom Line with Paul Bartel on a Monday night, which was a night devoted to writers reading what they had written.
Uh-huh.
And I got the idea that Marshall and I could read Sin City Fables. So,
and do a better job than those that were performing.
Yes. So we did that. And then we started to read the fables on the performance art circuit. Sometimes we'd make as much as $35 for a night.
Okay.
And the audience response was really good. And at that point, we thought we really should do something more with this. Oh, also, we were plagiarized.
What?
By another performance artist who ultimately did it at some festival at Lincoln Center.
Wait, who's this?
Here in New York.
We don't want to mention her name because that would be wrong to do, but let's just say that she used, what are they, inflatables, large rubber inflatables.
But anyway, so...
So the most performance artists.
No, we knew we had to do something.
Yeah.
So we wanted to get music... And we fastened on Fran Landesman, whose big song, two big songs, are jazz classics. One is Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most, and the other one is The Ballad of the Sad Young Men. And she'd been living in London for a really long time. So we went to London and talked her into being our lyricist. And she's been working with a composer named Simon Wallace for a while. So Simon is the composer.
Okay.
And we're just totally thrilled that we're working with those people.
And the songs came out beautiful, just beautiful.
So is there a next step?
Well, that's what we're waiting to hear.
We don't know.
So we're waiting to hear. We had a wonderful director, Stuart Ross, who's wrote and directed
and created
Forever Plaid, right?
Plaid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which ran forever. So.
Well, I'm so glad that it went so great for you guys. And unfortunately, I kind of have to wrap this up. But this is just
No. Let's keep talking. With you, maybe get an audience for you.
Yeah, a third person, maybe. Yeah.
To me.
Let me ask also, Marshall, you're what, 70 now, 71?
I'm 47.
Well, you don't look it. Let me tell you.
I know, I don't look it. I look a little older, but I am only 47, and I started in television when I was 4.
But here's a question, and feel free not to, well, I hope you'll answer it, because it is a worrisome thing. We figure that you are not a spelt person, and I imagine you don't necessarily have the healthiest eating habits and other...
I do. I'm very good.
Are you really?
I'm a very good boy, yes. I finish my plate.
But, I mean, are you worried? I mean, you've made it
no,
to...
No, I have no problems. I'm a happy boy. I just want to lose some weight, that's all.
Can you?
I've always been chunky, yeah.
Well, there's... No, you're more than... No, I mean, you're more than that. And that's
no,
why...
No. I'm less than that. You saw the sardine thing. That's me and my apogee.
Right. Oh, did you lose
Marshall's
a lot of...
Marshall's a bit thinner than he was when he did the
sardine. Yeah, I am a bit thinner.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm very glad to hear. Are you consciously trying to lose more, or are you ever comfortable?
I always want to lose more. There's never an amount that I want to have more. I want less.
Because I think, I remember...
Yeah, I am.
Running into you guys on the street like 15 years ago, I mean, you know, you're kind of hard not to spot. And you're just trying to say, hi, you know, I'm a great fan. I remember you walking with a cane back then. Or maybe it was just kind of a...
My ankle.
A visual. Oh, it was an ankle thing.
I had surgery on my ankle.
Oh!
And
Okay.
The doctor cut me open, and they put metal plates in my ankle. That's why I had a cane.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I only had a cane like 1 or 2 days, and that was it. Unless it was not me. No. Unless it was someone who looked like me. It wasn't me, because
right.
I didn't wear a cane that
often. Wait a minute. One last story.
Oh, yeah.
All right. We were also restaurant reviewers at one point for the Soho Weekly News, and the premise was that that restaurant reviewers really aren't anonymous, that everybody knows who they are.
Okay.
And so we said the restaurant knows who we are, and the Soho Weekly News had no budget anyway, so everybody knows who we are. The restaurant invited us, and our little, the thing that went on top of the column said, even if they sent out for the food that they served us, we would eat it and we would report on it.
Okay.
They would eat everything and they did.
Right. So we arrived at this restaurant and they looked at us like we were crazy because they said, oh no.
You were just in here. We
right.
were.
We had imposters.
What? Oh my.
Who had gone to this restaurant and said they were us and had gotten a free meal.
And they didn't even look like us.
Yeah, because you guys are pretty, you know...
Yes, we are singular.
Yeah. And by the way, the one question that I guess I should have asked right up front, Alpha Betty is such an unusual name. You might as well tell our listeners...
Made it up.
No.
It's birth certificate.
My parents are from Norway, and my father's name was Alf. A-L-F.
Uh-huh.
So my name is Alpha. And my mother's name was Borghild, but that's very difficult for... Americans to wrap their brain around. So she always said, call me Betty.
Alpha Betty.
So then I was called Alpha Betty.
And then Paul Simon wrote that song. You can call me Alpha and I'll call you Betty.
Oh.
So he was our friend in those days.
Maybe you should have left me the jokes. I don't know.
No. I'm in charge. And
well,
I'm in charge.
Well, it has been wonderful to have both of you in charge of this interview. It's been... So people can...
Best interview you've ever had.
It's up there. I have to say, it's way up there. You guys have been fantastic. And everybody, go to ABE Books.
ABE,
go to YouTube.
Oh, and go to YouTube also, look for Marshall, M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L, E-F-R-O-N, and Alphabetti will be behind him typing madly and wonderfully. I want to thank you so much for being so great in the day road. What was that? What?
You'll pay us? Give us the money now?
Oh, well, I have to say,
it's been really a lot of fun to talk to you.
Well, yeah.
And it's wonderful that someone is interested.
Well, thank you, and really best of health and best of luck to both of you.
Yeah, how about an audience?
And you
how about providing an audience? Send us an audience. We want that. We want that more than life itself.